Most introductory courses on the history of literature begin with Gilgamesh, largely out of obligation. The long and arduous journey is one of humanity's oldest and most popular storytelling idioms. Every civilization has an ancient myth where a hero goes on an epic quest, faces numerous hardships, and changes the world while being changed by it. This plot template is something that people find emotionally satisfying across a wide spectrum of cultures, nationalities, and historical eras. Japanese shonen manga and video games have crafted an especially successful variation of this formula. Hundreds of top-selling manga feature a protagonist hammering through a gauntlet of foes who get incrementally tougher and tougher until our hero gets to a seemingly invincible final boss. Akira Toriyama's Dragon Ball is hardly the first manga franchise to exploit this form of story construction, but it's arguably the most successful. Dragon Ball's roots go deep, and we'll be touching upon some of its sources in this episode. Still, there's something about it that caused it to resonate with audiences in a way that its forebears and rivals usually never could manage. We'll also be exploring that. My name is Ryan. This is a real deep dive. Joining me on this episode is our resident anime person, Leticia. Welcome back, Leticia.
Thank you very much.
You last joined us for Pokemon, and I asked what you would like to do for the follow-up, and you suggested that we talk about Dragon Ball in some capacity. What is it about Dragon Ball that made you want to talk about it?
There's something about fighting more and more powerful people, like the whole villain of the week sort of thing, that really appeals to me, because Goku will try to punch them and they'll dodge, and then he has to go and train, and then he comes back after he's trained and he punches them again, and this time they can't dodge because he's a millisecond too fast, and they just get blown away, and it's just like, wow, hard work and determination really does work out.
It's often said that dopamine is the pleasure chemical, and that is sort of true, but people often mistakenly believe that dopamine comes when the goal is attained. That's when you get your hit, and not really. The dopamine comes in anticipation of the hit, and very frequently a near miss where you do not get your gratification causes a bigger dopamine thing, which seems to be your body's way of telling you to keep trying.
I mean, that sounds about right. I know when I mess something up, it's sort of, I feel a stronger attachment to it than if I just did it right the first time.
For that, let's do the plot summary of, I picked out a specific Dragon Ball film, Dragon Ball Z Fusion Reborn, which came out in 1995. I thought that the movies would be an easier way to condense this into a podcast episode than just doing a string of episodes, because, guys, Dragon Ball can kind of drag a little bit, and very frequently Toriyama will start a story very strongly and not quite know how to finish it. Those are very common criticisms of his work. But the movies generally keep things to a tight 55 minutes or so. But anyways, Fusion Reborn opens in the afterworld, where a teenage Oni is manning a cleansing machine for Evil Ki, and the loud volume of his Walkman distracts him from his duties, causing the machine to explode. The Oni is engulfed by the freed evil spirit essence and transforms into a massive, childlike monster with dimensional manipulation abilities. And as a result of this, a whole bunch of deceased people are removed from the spirit world and re-manifest on Earth. You see an old man who's like, I'm not a ghost, my legs work. And then there's this teenage lover named Juliet who is astonished that her former love, who, you know, is still alive, is, you know, in his 70s now. That sort of thing. Oh, also Hitler's back.
Hitler always comes back.
Hitler returns somehow. Goku and Picon are fighting in a tournament, a ghost tournament, when they are interrupted by the appearance of a strange crystal-like substance and are sent to investigate the disturbance by the Grand Kai. They find the afterlife's check-in station to be encased in a crystal-like barrier, which is also immune to their energy blasts. From inside of the station, its trapped attendant, King Yemma, directs them to monitor Janemba, the result of that teenage Oni getting bathed in the evil chemicals. Janemba, who can only recite his own name like a Pokemon, refuses to drop the barrier. This causes Goku to lure Janemba down lower into hell, while Picon works to free Yenma. Meanwhile, on Earth, which is now under siege by an army of zombies, soldiers, and past Dragon Ball villains led by Frieza, they attack a city until Gohan and Videl intervene, with the former destroying him, causing the villains to flee in terror. The two of them, along with Bulma, Goten, and Trunks, gather the magic Dragon Balls and summon the dragon Shenlong to ask them to rebuild the barrier between the world of the living and the dead. But the dragon is unable to do so. It's beyond his power, which is a little odd, because doesn't the dragon resurrect people all the time? Like, that's the main reason they summon the dragon more often than not?
Yeah, I'm guessing what they wanted to do, though, was alter the balance of the world itself. It wasn't just to bring one particular soul or person back. And I don't think he can fix that.
You know, the dragon's like, you got any other wishes? And they don't. So the movie ends with, like, the dragon being like, hey, how about that wish? I would really like to go back in the Dragon Balls now.
Yeah, he's just sort of standing there like, so you guys gonna wish for anything, or am I just gonna be standing here?
Meanwhile, in Hell, Janemba uses his unorthodox powers to defeat Goku until Goku just, like, gives up and powers up to Super Saiyan 3, shaking Otherworld as he does it. And at that point, he seemingly kills Janemba. However, this causes Janemba to transform into a much smaller, albeit far more powerful and sinister form, Super Janemba. Goku is overwhelmed by this manifestation until Vegeta just suddenly intervenes. Vegeta, who is also dead, has regained a corporeal body of some form, just in time to help. Help in a very Vegeta sense of the term. He's like, you are weak and pathetic, Goku. Stand aside so I can take care of things because I am better than you, even though I'm totally not.
And then he proceeds to get his ass kicked. What a surprise.
Yeah, the two Saiyans are still no match for Super Janemba and are forced to hide in a spike pit of some kind. Goku proposes that the only way for them to overcome their foe is to perform the fusion dance together, where they merge like a crystal gem into a more powerful, cohered version of each other, which presumably will augment their best qualities. Vegeta, however, refuses to join bodies with Goku. He is arrogant, and he does not want to admit weakness, and he definitely doesn't want to go through something as intimate as fusion.
No, it's kind of one of those things where Vegeta, he's sort of like a Tundurane, but he's more heartfelt about it.
Meanwhile, Picon continues to try to free Yenma to no avail, and in his anger, insults the crystal substance, which causes it to slightly crack. This leads Picon to think that verbally dressing down the barrier is the key to shattering it, and just, he runs out of synonyms for moron very quickly. So he decides to just take off and go and aid Goku and Vegeta in their fight. After much persuasion, Vegeta ultimately concedes to fusion with Goku, but he fails to extend his forefinger in their little pre-fusion dance, resulting in a weak, obese form that is known as Veku. Janemba beats Veku severely and almost kills him, but the fusion wears off and Goku and Vegeta escape in time. Picon then arrives just in time to stall Janemba while Goku and Vegeta attempt the fusion again, this time successfully transforming into the immensely powerful Gogeta, who swiftly gains the advantage over Janemba and uses his power to cleanse the demon of the evil essence inside him, causing him to revert to his teenaged Oni form, who should maybe be a little more careful when it comes to sweeping up evil ki chambers on his Walkman.
You think that, but I mean, with child labor these days, they hire anybody off the street.
Yeah, even after they're dead. With Janemba vanquished, the hold over reality disappears, and the deceased return to the afterlife, including Hitler, who just got a massive beat down from Super Saiyan Trunks and Goten. They also fused themselves, and it's mostly just in a show-offy way. They already had him on the ropes. After sharing a good-natured farewell with Goku, Vegeta reverts to his spirit form and disappears. Back on Earth, Gohan, Videl, Goten, and Trunks depart back home. And Goten and Trunks have figured out that Vegeta and Goku are responsible for fixing everything afterwards, but they cheekily refuse to tell the rest of the gang about it. End of film. So, what was your main takeaway from this one?
My main takeaway was just, I guess it was a bit of confusion because, or what I remember from the Buu saga is that that's when they learned about fusion. So I was like, why does Goku already know about fusion during the movie? When's the movie set?
The movie is set, like, in between chapters of the Buu saga.
So does that mean that he learned about fusion already during the Buu saga but just hadn't done it yet, or?
Yeah, this is before Super Buu shows up.
Okay, because canonically I don't know if the movies actually match up with the TV show at all. I don't think the movies are canon, are they?
I have heard it argued that the movies are not canon.
Just because there's too many plot threads to this, it just confuses me.
for the creation of Dragon Ball as a whole. Fond of Chinese martial arts films like Enter the Dragon and Drunken Master, Akira Toriyama wanted to develop a kung fu manga following the conclusion of his very popular series Dr. Slump. He decided to model the initial plot and characters on the 16th century novel Journey to the West. Arguably the defining national epic of China, although Romance of the Three Kingdoms is a contender as well, Journey to the West centers upon a Buddhist monk transporting sacred texts from India to China and braving numerous monsters and obstacles along the way. The monk is given several protectors to assist him, all of whom are there to atone for their sins. The most prominent is the Monkey King, a mischievous yet powerful trickster who travels by flying cloud and has massive kung fu powers. Being the Asian opposite number of something like the Iliad or the Nibelung, Journey to the West got countless adaptations for centuries. There have been stage plays, ballets, film, TV shows, video games, and concept albums based on Journey to the West. The piece itself is a riff on Hindu spirituality, particularly on their deities. The Monkey King bears a strong resemblance to the Hindu deity Hanuman, for example. Well, yeah, Dragon Ball is hardly the only anime or manga pop culture to riff on Journeys of the West. Starzinger, One Piece, Sayuki, and the God of High School also borrow elements from Journeys of the West in their texts in places. Broadly speaking, Bulma is the monk, Goku is the Monkey King, and Yamcha and Oolong were the other pilgrims. The first few installments of Dragon Ball loosely adapt the beginning of Journey to the West, but Toriyama quickly moved things elsewhere.
I remember watching Dragon Ball when I was younger, and I always thought it was really cool how Goku flew in the cloud. And he had a little monkey tail.
Yep, that's why.
It was really cute, though, him just flying on the cloud, and him, and then he had the pole, too. He had the extending pole that would use to hit people with it, and it was just so cool how he used to fight people. And he was like, he was dancing around them. He could predict their every single move. And there was a big comedy bit to it, too. And now he would fight people.
Yeah, that's all in the source novel. It's not unlike, say, Thor being on the Avengers. You take this little piece of folklore and then throw it into your silly comic book.
I can see that.
The other core influence on Dragon Ball was the 19th century Japanese novel Satomi Hakanden, in which a ragtag group of heroes go on an epic quest to collect 8 Buddhist prayer beads that will have magical properties when brought together.
Wow, something about like collecting the 7 Dragon Balls, but there you go.
Toriyama named it Dragon Ball because of Enter the Dragon, and he found that a lot of kung fu movies had dragon in the name somewhere, so he thought that that would be commercially viable, particularly in Bruceploitation movies. We talked about those briefly on the End of the Dragon episode, where after Bruce Lee died, a bunch of low-rent Hong Kong studios would churn out fake sequels with guys who kind of looked like Bruce Lee, and they would call them Bruce Lee with an L-I instead of E-E, and this is technically legal. Toriyama thought that Dragon Ball would be a quick palate cleanser following the arduous Dr. Slump proceedings, and that it would conclude after about a year, presumably after the main protagonist gathered the Dragon Balls. He didn't think that there'd be anywhere to go after Goku and Bulma finished their quest. And it turns out that the commercial success of the series forced him to reconsider that.
Yeah, I don't think he was prepared for it to be that popular. Because when you read the very first, I owned the first volume of Dragon Ball, and I remember reading it, and you could just sort of tell that this was the adventure he was going to go on. He was going to go with Bulma, collect the 7 Dragon Balls, then they were going to get a wish, and then probably fight a big bad guy, and the series would end. Instead, it just went on, and it was really crazy.
Yeah, looking to change things up from Dr. Slump, Toriyama consciously avoided European and North American cultural influences, making the world of Dragon Ball a mix of Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Indonesian, Indian, and Arabic folklore. Dragon Ball shifted direction when editor Kazuhiko Torishima commented that Goku was a little too plain to be a hero. This led Toriyama to add characters like Master Roshi and Krillin. This dovetailed into all the characters enrolling in the Tenkaichi Budokai martial arts tournament. Questing for the Dragon Balls took a backseat to plots focusing on hand-to-hand combat, and this is the moment when Dragon Ball began to explode in popularity. Following the tournament, Toriyama kept the series going by having Goku battle a series of extraterrestrial invaders, starting with Piccolo. Since Goku is the most powerful fighter on Earth, he had to start bringing in aliens. Toriyama soon retconned that Goku wasn't human himself, and was descended from a race of alien conquerors known as the Saiyans. The next few Dragon Ball arcs centered on Goku thwarting invasion attempts from various Saiyan conquistadors, most notably Vegeta. Frieza, who conquers planets in order to sell them to colonizers, was modeled after predatory real estate speculators who exploited a Japanese asset price bubble in the late 1980s. Toriyama hated those guys. People who would just, like, buy up houses and keep people from being able to afford them, and then sell them to people who are already rich as investment opportunities. I can relate.
I can relate to that as well. Owning a home is really expensive these days. And it's one of those things where it's like, I keep seeing things in the news that are like, millennials are still living with their parents and they aren't having kids. And it's like, look at the way the economy is right now. Why would I have kids and why would I move out and buy my own house?
Yeah, why are you trying to shame me into not buying fabric softener?
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, millennials are killing the industry of this, that, or the other thing. It's like, well, maybe they should die.
Yeah, diamond industry, oh, boo-hoo. Following the Cell arc, Toriyama planned to make Goku's son Gohan into the series' main character, but he was talked out of that. The manga ran from December 3rd, 1984 to June 5th, 1995 in Weekly Shonen Jump. A sales juggernaut, Toriyama stopped because of exhaustion and not because of a lack of reader interest. He could have just kept going. Manga cartoonists work very long, hard hours and are frequently driven to the point where they ignore their own health. It is not unusual for them to die young, which unfortunately is what happened to Akira Toriyama.
Yeah, it's amazing how these days 68 is considered young, but back in the day it was considered pretty old. But now, somebody dies at 68 and you're like, oh, what killed them?
Yeah, once you get past like 70 or so, people just stop asking that question. But apparently not until the very vestige. Toei adapted the first 194 manga chapters into an anime entitled Dragon Ball, reasonably enough, which ran for 153 episodes on Fuji TV from 1986 to 1989. A rating smash, Dragon Ball was exported to 81 countries by the end of the 90s. Instead of continuing the anime for the part of the manga where Goku is an adult, Toei rebooted the series as Dragon Ball Z, adapting the final 325 chapters of the manga into 291 episodes. That ran from 1989 to 1996 and was even more popular than its predecessor. Having run out of source material, Dragon Ball GT was produced by Toei as an out-of-continuity side story, although Toriyama still oversaw things and contributed character designs. It aired 64 episodes from 96 to 97. In 2009, the 20th anniversary of Dragon Ball was marked with Dragon Ball Z Kai, a re-edit of the original anime that removed extraneous plot points and hewed a little closer to the stated text of the manga. Dragon Ball Super, a direct sequel to Dragon Ball Z, was produced from 2015 to 2018 and aired 131 episodes. There have been 20 theatrically released anime films, including the one that we just talked about. There's also been a slew of TV specials and one widely despised live-action Hollywood film.
No, we don't talk about that film.
Although sometimes we talk about the unlicensed live-action Korean knockoff, which is terrible, but in a fun way.
Oh, I didn't know there was a Korean knockoff of it.
Oh, I'll link it to you. It's cute. Dragon Ball Z Fusion Reborn takes place during the Majin Buu saga, roughly before Super Buu first appears, as I already said. The film sold 3.2 million tickets in Japan, making 2.16 billion yen, which is about $23 million. This film has occasionally been given limited theatrical releases as a double feature. Portugal, going through a Dragon Ball fad, paired it with Dragon Ball Z Wrath of the Dragon. In 2018, US theaters screened it in a double bill with Dragon Ball Z Bardock, the Father of Goku. Got a DVD release in 2006 and was paired with Wrath of the Dragon for a 2009 Blu-ray. But yeah, let's talk about the cast for this. First and very much foremost, Masako Nozawa. She was the voice of Goku, Gohan, and Goten. She's generally known as the Eternal Boy. That's her little nickname in Japanese circles, although she prefers playing elderly lady roles now that she is currently 87 as of this recording. I have occasionally come across lists that, like, you know, facts about your favorite cartoons that will ruin them for you, and one of them is like, oh, the guy who voiced Goku is actually a 75-year-old grandma. And my reaction to that was, okay, by ruin you mean make more awesome, right?
Yeah, it's one of those things where if you don't know that it's a woman, you won't really notice it. But after you know it's a woman that voices Goku, you can kind of see the differences in the male and the female voice, but only a little bit.
Yeah, and at least by my ear, she's still doing convincing little boy voices, even though she's, you know, getting pretty close to 90 at this point.
Yeah, I think she does a good job with them.
Yeah, that's still her in Dragon Ball Super. And, you know, maybe the work is keeping her young. She hasn't slowed down at all.
Yeah, I mean, work keeps you young, they say.
For the English dub, Sean Schemmel voices Goku, Kyle Hebert as Gohan, and Carr Edwards as Goten. So you needed three dudes to cover up for this one lady when you're talking about American Dragon Ball. Alright, next we have Ryo Horikawa as Vegeta. I almost certainly butchered that. Christopher R. Sabat is Vegeta, as well as Piccolo and Yamcha on the American dub. So I guess it's the other way around. We're going to be talking about this a little bit later, but do you prefer Goku or Vegeta when you're revisiting Dragon Ball?
I'm going to be honest, I'm probably a bigger fan of Vegeta.
You know, that's a pretty common one. I feel that Vegeta has a more relatable and constructive character arc going through the course of the series. I had a much easier time connecting with him than I did with, you know, Mr. Perfect Goku.
Yeah, I mean, Goku, he's like the golden boy of the series. He can do no wrong and he can never fail. Vegeta, though, Vegeta started off as a bad guy who kind of, sort of turned into a good guy, who then permanently became a good guy, but he always feels inferior to Goku.
Yeah, and we love that. And the voice actors, whether we're talking about Japanese or English dub, they sort of have that myth try-hard energy to it. And yes, very well done. Then we have Takeshi Kusawa as Trunks. Laurie Bailey voices Trunks in the American version. Hiromi Sura is Bulma, Tiffany Vollmer in America. Ryusei Nakao was Frieza, Linda Young in the American dub. And I don't have too much to say about them in this. They don't really contribute too much as characters. I feel that Bulma gets sidelined a lot. Sometimes I suspect that Toriyama only really hooked her up with Vegeta to give her something to do in the Dragon Ball Z era. Because, you know, in the beginning, she's the monk. She's the one questing for the Dragon Balls. And then once they get them, where do you go from there? She can't punch anybody. They only sometimes need gadgets. For this, we have Tesho Genda. He was Janimbra, which is mostly just him shouting his own name. And then the psychic demon who doesn't have any speaking lines at all. It's a pretty thankless role in this. All he's doing is, like, you know, poke speak. So it was interesting to look up what he does other than that. Apparently, he does the Japanese dubs for both Tigger and Optimus Prime.
Oh, that's something.
Yeah, apparently he has the appropriate energy for both of those characters. Jim Ferranda is the guy screaming Janimbra in the English dub. Alright, and I guess that brings us to themes. The first thing I wrote down was white supremacy. Because, you know, I'm gonna harsh everyone's mellow about this psychedelic fight cartoon by bringing up something horrible.
I mean, Hitler was in the episode pretty clearly, so I don't know how much it's gonna really harsh the mellow after seeing that.
Yeah, I suppose that character has just less impact in the Far East because of, you know, distance. Like, you can throw that guy in there and have him be, like, a goofy little cartoon dude, but, yeah, anyways. Dragon Ball was first localized for American audiences in 1995, which is also when internet access first started becoming accessible to significant portions of America's working class. As such, American Dragon Ball fandom has had knee-jerk punchlines about Super Saiyans being an endorsement of Hitler's master race nonsense almost from the jump. It's popular for anime nerds even today, although that's kind of been tampered down because apparently the blue-haired Saiyans are even stronger than the golden-haired ones. To speculate that Dragon Ball didn't get on English dub for almost 7 years because it was tied too closely to fascist ideology. This isn't true, but it's not difficult to see where this assumption came from. Japan can be a deeply racist country, and it has a long and ugly history with eugenics, and much of its pop culture, notably in Attack on Titan, openly endorses fascist beliefs. And I'm saying this as an American, we're not exactly sinless in that regard. Nazis believed that they were Aryans, a superior master race that's been driven to the margins by inferior races, especially Jews. According to them, their central goal was to purge Europe of the degenerate bloodlines and thereby triggering a glorious rebirth where the greatness of their founding fathers was restored to their mighty nation. Nazis distinguished Aryans from other races by a number of traits, with the most famous being blonde hair and blue eyes. This is connected by some to Dragon Ball because Saiyans, when they ascend to a higher plane of power, find their hair transformed blonde. This is a reach, but you can see how an American anime nerd in 1997 could get there. And it is a reach. Toriyama came up with Super Saiyans because inking all of that black hair was a real chore, and with ever-looming deadlines on the horizon, making the Super Saiyans blonde gave him and his staff a little bit of a break. Fusion Reborn lampshades this assumption by having Hitler being one of the supervillains who escapes from hell. And in the English dub of this movie, he cracks a joke about possibly recruiting Trunks and Goten because of their hair. Teehee. In a wider sense, the master Aryan race theory originates in an early 20th century movement in anthropology and genetics to discover a root race that all humans evolved from. Broadly speaking, because there's a lot to this, this happened because the scientific racism of the 19th century was getting debunked. People started to figure out that phrenology was bullshit, but they weren't prepared to admit that non-white people weren't all that different from white people aside from the obvious melanin part. Aryan became an academic shorthand for the idea that Indo-European and Indo-Iranian people shared a root language and a root ancestry that distinguished them from African people. A since-discredited sub-theory is that a segment of Aryans were the first white people, and that they invented all of European language and culture, and were therefore better than everyone else. This was coupled with occultist conspiracy theories that pre-Christian Aryans were descended from survivors of Atlantis or some other super-advanced lost civilization that ruled the world while the Africans and the Asians were still cavemen. This was largely pulled from a specious reading of some Hindu texts, specifically the Arya Sama. And yes, Arya and Aryan are rooted together. Of course, a central tenet of Nazism is that race mixing dilutes the gene pool and creates inferior humans. This is still widely believed by racists, even though it's the opposite of the truth. Genetic diversity is good, and inbreeding is very, very bad. This is the spicy take I'm giving you here. Inbreeding's bad. Gohan, Trunks, and Goten are mixed-race children. They have Saiyan fathers and human mothers. Yet, because they all were able to become Super Saiyan while they were children, that's a demonstration that they're in a sort of a genetic improvement on their parents. They figured it out first. At the very least, their mixed human DNA did not interfere with that. They surpassed their purebred fathers. That's kind of the opposite of Nazi ideology. But yeah, eugenics is a pseudoscience. Sure, if you breed someone for blue eyes, you'll get blue eyes, but we're so much more complicated than that. Dog breeding is a solid example of the folly of selective breeding for one or two desirable traits. It creates severe genetic issues elsewhere, leading to serious health concerns in most purebred breeds. Pugs are an obvious example. Mutts are healthier than purebreds, dog breeders are cruel weirdos, and we shouldn't be emulating them when it comes to humanity's future. We fought a world war over this 80 years ago, and the bad guys lost. Their crackpot theories have been thoroughly debunked time and again, but they still won't go away, as evidenced by the neo-Nazi Great Replacement Theory gaining traction in Republican discourse. Yes, I found a way to link it to that. Okay, that ends things for the bummer part of the thematic portions. Now we're going to talk about something more fun, Vegeta versus Goku. In professional wrestling, character archetypes can be simplified down to heels and baby faces, or, you know, good guys and bad guys. Heels are just as popular as baby faces, and performing as one arguably requires more skill. Getting an entire crowd to fucking hate you is an art of some kind. For actors, being the villain also seems like the more fun role. You get the very best lines, and you don't have to wear a big black Batman condom suit. In fact, the villainous actor seems to be having so much fun that they start to become likable. Getting an audience to boo and hiss is actually a form of endorsement, and at this point, fewer storytelling devices are more tried and true than having a charismatic, sympathetic villain take a heroic turn and transition into becoming a roguishly appealing good guy. Vegeta is one of those, and while I don't have hard data, I often suspect that he's more popular than Goku. Weird internet nerds seem to like him more, or at least they identify with him more. And yeah, Goku has his stands. Most of them seem to be gym rats who connect with his dedication to training, you know, gradually becoming stronger day by day until you're the best possible version of yourself that you can be. I can understand and get behind that, and it seems to be why the same people who like Superman. But, you know, only one person can be the best, and what does that leave the rest of us? And where does that leave Vegeta, who is definitely not the best? Vegeta's original goal of conquering Earth and proving himself to be the most powerful Saiyan has been thwarted. Goku is objectively the better fighter. So, not having that anymore, Vegeta found a new purpose. He found love with Bulma. He became a dad. I mean, Goku did those two things too, but he's kind of an absentee deadbeat to Chi-Chi and his kids. Like, people are always talking about how Chi-Chi is kind of an angry shrew, and is like, can you really blame her? Like,
no, you really can't. I mean, her husband's always either dead or training, or he's training, but he's dead and he doesn't want to come back to life because he's busy training.
Granted, she did goad him into a marriage proposal by approaching him when he was a child and didn't fully understand what was going on, and then she held it to him later. It, you know, she also suspects that he died just so he can get out of doing the dishes, and I don't think she's entirely wrong to suspect that.
I mean, it's sort of like, Goku, can you help me change the baby's diaper? Oh no, Chi-Chi, I'm having a heart attack, I'm dying.
Nah, I gotta go train. I'm not even here, you're talking to a wall. Yeah, Vegeta's not the best, but eventually, over the course of Dragon Ball, he finds a way to be okay with that. And pretty much nobody accomplishes their dreams and ambitions. Not me, not the person listening to this, and probably not the people who have already clicked out. We don't do this in the way we fantasize about them. For a good chunk of us, it'd be flat out dangerous for us to get exactly what we want. Most of us are, for the most part, more like Vegeta than Goku. Most of us have to find a new path after failure, and we experience that over and over again. When people chalk up the list of things that they experienced in their life, I think there are going to be more Vegeta moments than Goku moments.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of looking back at your life and going, damn it, damn it, damn it, just like Vegeta goes.
Yeah, Kakarot. Alright, well, that's everything I've written down about Dragon Ball Z. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't touched upon yet?
I just want to say that action anime in general, but I know Dragon Ball and for Naruto have been really popular in the black community. I think it's because of that whole underdog who rises up and beats back the big forces thing that you kind of see in there. And it's just one of those things where it's like, it's interesting to see how anime has affected the black community. But it's been really popular, and fighting anime and shonen anime in general is the most popular genre with them. So I guess I just like to see a good beatdown.
Yeah, you may not know this just from listening to my voice, but I'm not qualified to speak from lived experience on that specific subject. I am incredibly painfully white. However, if you are curious about the subject that Letitia brought up, I would strongly recommend a video essay from FD Signifier about how anime has affected the black community. He goes into very deep specifics about it, interviews a whole bunch of young black kids at anime cons, talks about his own experiences with it and how that has shifted from, you know, he's in his early 40s, so he's just like, anime is a lot different now, it's a lot more socially accepted now. I find like a lot more young black kids are like, yeah, Dragon Ball, One Piece, and what an interesting shift that is. Although he does spend a lot of time talking about how he doesn't like how fascist Attack on Titan is, and if you want an edgelord, tragic backstory anti-hero saga, you are much better off with Berserk, and I do agree with him on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of fascism in Attack on Titan. You don't notice it at first, but once it gets to the point where they're fighting at Marley, you're sort of just like, this kind of reeks of fascism just a little bit here.
Yeah, I didn't even make it that far. I was going, okay, something ain't right about this. Okay, well, if that's it, thanks for listening, everybody. Join us next time, and we will be talking about something else.